Cranes News Pro is a publication for news media professionals. They have, in their latest edition, recognized some of the top educators in journalism in the country. And among those is a native of Hammond and also a Purdue University professor of communication, Carolyn Curiel, with us to talk about not only the honor, but what she does on the West Lafayette campus. Thank you very much for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Well, if you will, tell us what the organization that you are working with in particular, which is an interesting institute, the Institute for Civic Communication, is all about.
It's a rather interesting story how this came about. It started with Purdue offering me an honorary doctorate back in 2008. And having graduated from Purdue, I knew where the needs were however many years ago I graduated, 40 years ago. And I really felt that if those had not been addressed, they needed to be, and that was a focus on the students and educating them in a way that they could become best contributing members of society, civic society. And so I started there as chief of staff to the president at the time of the university, and after a year took my faculty appointment to teach. And I asked the students not to call me Professor Curiel or Dr. Curiel. I don't have an earned doctorate. I have an honorary doctorate from Purdue and from Calumet College of St. Joseph, both. But I want to be called Ambassador Curiel because they need to know that they can achieve in civic society in a way that can make a difference. And so I've been teaching for the last 7+ years, and it's been an absolute delight. We have many students contributing in big ways in Washington and elsewhere, and I'm really thrilled.
When this organization was set up, the Institute was set up, it obviously is certainly that has helped in great part to help Purdue University, which, by the way, doesn't have a formal journalism program like some of the other universities in Indiana, but it has a very strong communication program, and from it have come a great number of very illustrious graduates, people like Brian Lamb. Maybe the name doesn't ring a bell, but if you've watched C-SPAN on television, on cable, you've seen Brian Lamb until his retirement from active work with the TV network. He's been very involved, and he, too, is a Purdue University graduate. And in turn, he has brought not only the idea of journalism to Purdue University, but in turn, as you have, I understand, helped a lot of students out in getting their careers started by getting them off on the right foot.
Right. So one of the first things I did was go to visit Brian Lamb. He had not been engaged at the university in a way that got him regularly in front of students, which I thought was a big shame. He always had been somebody that I admired. He founded the network C-SPAN. It was his idea. And I asked him, I said, I would really like to start a Washington program. This is a huge university with a worldwide reputation, and it seems that we should have a Washington program. My idea is an intensive program in May. We called it a Maymester, and he immediately said, bring the students to C-SPAN. That can be your classroom. And so from C-SPAN, we launched students every place that I've worked, the White House, State Department, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they go to Capitol Hill, and any place where there are influencers, these students go, and they don't have, there are programs where you're one of 500 students in an audience, and maybe you'll get to shake the hand of the person on stage. These are small meetings. We fill a conference room and only a conference room, and they get to ask questions one-on-one. We've met with the chair of the Senate Budget Committee, with the deputy press secretary at the White House, with the office of the number two person at State Department. These students have one-on-ones with them through my Maymester program. And further with Brian has been somebody who, because of his years in the business and knowing how things work and being a non-political observer in Washington, he has brought tremendous value to these students. We devised something for him called the Masterclass. And we bring him to Purdue at least once a year to do a master class where it's all very topical about what is going on, and the students are engaged in very intense discussion with him. So he's been a wonderful friend and partner.
We're talking with Professor Carolyn Curiel. She is a professor of journalism at Purdue University in the West Lafayette campus. She's also a Hammond native, as well as a graduate of Purdue. She has now picked up a special honor from Crane's News Pro, the organization for news media professionals, as one of the top educators in journalism in the country. And Professor Curiel, when you were a student and living in as a child in Hammond, did you see anything that influenced you or was some kind of incentive to make you want to pursue journalism?
Oh, absolutely. I knew that Frank Reynolds was from Hammond, very famous broadcaster with ABC News, and his son, Dean Reynolds, they're both from Hammond, Indiana. Gene Shepherd, the humorist, wrote the book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. I was a voracious reader. If students there are not using the library, you want to travel the world, go to the library and pick up a book and learn about places that you may only dream right now of going to, but you can be there and you can come back home, as I have. It's the kind of experience I think that we want to encourage with our young people, is broaden your horizons of your mind, broaden the horizons that you see, broaden your thinking. And it's more than anything, I think, due to really great teachers in grade school, but mostly in high school, that I think I felt I needed to do something that would have an impact beyond my neighborhood. And that is something I'll always treasure. I'll never forget the Reverend Borsay, who was a professor of history, a teacher of history at Morton High School, where I graduated, who really gave me a feeling that you can do whatever you want. And there were others. Mrs. Bonebrake, who taught algebra. It was algebra honors. I never thought of myself as somebody that could do advanced algebra. But when you have a teacher like that, it is something that, it's transformative, Chris, because you think about yourself in perhaps a different way. And so all of those things, not one thing in particular, lead me to feel that without the baseline that you get in the schools coming up, it's nearly impossible to achieve. Once you start becoming an adult, you need that baseline. And it's one of the things I'm very passionate about my hometown of Hammond, Indiana.
Professor Curiel, I'd like to ask a question. It's a professional question as well as a, I guess, sort of a personal question in a way. You have on your resume some great credentials, having worked in the White House during the Clinton administration as a senior speechwriter and a special assistant to President Clinton. You also, during his second term of office, was nominated and became confirmed to become the U.S. ambassador to Belize. In light of what you know has happened in the White House from your years there, and what you see is developing in the White House these days under the Trump administration, what do you tell your students when the topic comes up as to how life is like in the White House, and in particular, how it is when you happen to be a member of the media?
It is an interesting journey that we've taken. And if you every White House is going to be different just by nature of the leadership involved. I mean, that's true of any large organization. And the White House itself is a small part of government in that its size is small. There are not that many people who actually have the White House credential. There are more people in the agencies. And but you set the tone from a White House. And so my experience during the Clinton years was that we very much sought to improve a lot of the middle class. And so that was a mantra. We very much sought to look at those who were underprivileged and attempted to expand opportunity on the education front and safety in communities and even safety for women. It was during the Clinton years that we achieved the Violence Against Women Act. And that was a big achievement. And to keep families as safe and sound as they can be, and realizing that it's very hard for someone who has a very sick parent or a child newborn into the family to work a very tough job and then to also take care of that individual. And so the Family Leave Act was one of the first things that was accomplished then. And so it was that feeling of we can do good. And we worked very hard to do good. And, it's left to people to judge whether that was achieved or not. I can tell you that I still run across people who are taking advantage of leave from work to take care of a newborn or an ailing parent. The boomer generation certainly is facing that on a regular basis. I know I am. My parents are in their 90s right now. Mm-hmm. And so my chief motivation, in addition to helping students at Purdue, is I needed to be closer to my mom and dad. I was in New York, and there's no way a person of advanced age not familiar with the city is going to do well there. It's just not good. So I came home, closer to home. And I think it's important that we have those options in our lives, and that's part of what we try to expand there. So that was my experience. In terms of what I tell the students, Chris, mm-hmm. it's look at the facts. We analyze methods of communication. We analyze the history of presidential speeches and what presidents are trying to communicate. And so that is my personal expertise. I also look at foreign policy through the rubric of somebody who was chief of mission for an embassy, the first embassy to the South that also speaks English, and on the mainland. And it's the kind of thing that it sharpens critical thinking. We are a nonpartisan institute, Chris. It's very important to note that. Mm-hmm. I do not ever ask the students where they lean politically, but I tell them if you voice an opinion in class, you better back it up with facts, and they better be from a credible source. I don't care that it's a partial source, but it had better be credible. And so they know that, and they are required to keep up with current events and to give their take on it. So we don't get political in class. We judge things as they happen based on the facts as we know them, on the laws of the United States, the Constitution, and we have some pretty riveting discussions.
I would imagine, especially as the Trump administration has gotten established, and we already get an inkling of how the rest of his term of office is going to fare. We know that people are watching very closely what is happening in Washington. A lot of people we know voted for Donald Trump because they thought that he would make the changes that they felt that needed to be made in Washington that hadn't happened in the past decades. Even though we don't know yet how the administration is going to fare, we know people are upset. The people are upset certainly about some of the actions already. In fact, even as recently as this week, we've had people protesting in the town of Munster about the president's executive order concerning immigration. And there are a lot of people very concerned about that, and people very busy doing what they can to help folks, Syrian refugees and other refugees from Muslim countries that are listed as those in that executive order. Are you finding that when talking with students about this, as they learn how to cover the news, as they learn how to think analytically and to be able to express themselves analytically as what they, I'm sure, hope to be someday columnists or commentators, that they'll be able to put all these ideas in perspective.
Or leaders in government. Mm-hmm. We have students that are working on Capitol Hill right now and working as educators and working in think tanks in Washington. Some are at C-SPAN right now as full-time employees. So they're running the gamut around where they, one is at the Pentagon right now working as a consultant. I mean, it's the kind of thing that they, in their own way, will start their careers, hopefully do well and move their way up, and cause good change to happen. So I can't comment directly on what the president is doing. Mm-hmm. But I do tell the students, look to the law. You cannot control what a government official will say, but the law does come to bear on all of us. It's the great equalizer. It should be. And we look at the law and we see that some of the actions have been challenged thus far, and there may be others. We don't know. But yes, I think that this is we have discussed this era of change, and we're only 12 days into the new administration, as something that is, it's a good thing to have our democracy tested sometimes. And, you know, what is the power of the courts? What is the power of the people? What is the power of the presidency? All these things come to bear in a democracy. What is the power of the news media? They are all critical pieces of this wonderful thing we call America. And it's as a learning tool, and as, you know, looking at just clinically as a professor, it's a wonderful teaching tool, Chris.
Carolyn Curiel is a Hammond native, went to Morton High School, graduated from Morton, also attended and graduated from Purdue University. She has extensive experience in the media, as well as extensive experience working with the White House and in other portions of federal government. She is now the creator and the executive director of an organization on the West Lafayette campus called the Purdue Institute for Civic Communication. And she's been with us to talk about her life experiences, as well as what she gets to tell students in higher education every single day. Professor Curiel, thank you very much for being with us, and the best of luck with you as well as with the Institute. And we hope to hear more coming out here about how students have benefited from not only your experiences, but what they learned from their other professors at Purdue University.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
The town of Munster was the site of the latest protest against the president's executive order on immigration. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore reports that Muslims were supported in their cause by other religious organizations.
At Munster City Hall, hundreds gathered to speak out against President Trump's ban on Muslim immigration. Dr. Muhammad Kadami is president of the board of the Ileana Islamic Association.
We met here in solidarity, you know, against those discriminatory policies that, you know, the current administration is pursuing. That's what it is. That simply.
That
the message is, this is un-American.
Jewish, Muslim, and Christian faiths were represented at the vigil. They are here to show their support for the Muslim community in Northwest Indiana. Wafa Asiya's family is directly impacted by the ban.
My nephew, his wife is coming from Syria, and they halted all of her papers because of that, yeah.
How's he doing?
He is really in a stress, you know.
So she's stuck in Syria?
His wife is stuck in Syria, yes.
Mm-hmm. What's your message to the president?
He should stop. This America is based on freedom.
Representative Candelaria Reardon, Democrat of Munster, says she stands with the people at the vigil in support of Muslims.
We're talking about people that are being banned that have oftentimes, when the discussion of immigration comes up, we talk about illegal immigration and we talk about coming in the right way and all of these things. Well, these people that have been issued visas for travel to the United States have been fully vetted and they have come in the right way.
Organizers say they plan to have regular events to build solidarity and support for Muslims here in Northwest Indiana.
Ignorance is your worst enemy there. You know, if you know, you know, your friend, your neighbor, and so on, you know, you're much more likely to like them, love them, and work together.
Hey, Trump, let's be clear. Refugees are welcome here. Hey,
in Munster, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The Highland Town Council on Monday night voted against a proposal to renovate the long-vacant town theater. The goal of the project was to create an arts and culture district in Highland, with the hopes that the renovated theater would spur economic development in the area. The town council rejected the plans because of the high cost of the project. Redevelopment Director Cecile Pietro says that now only two options left. The first is for a private contractor to purchase the theater.
So if somebody would like to purchase it, we know it will cost about $2.9 million to renovate, and they would be welcome to do that.
The second option is demolition of the theater itself.
And we will take that site and try to acquire as many properties as we can, and then invite developers to come in and create a mixed-use area of both retail commercial with residential.
Cecile Pietro says that the project wouldn't have come as far as it did without the support of volunteers who worked on the project, those who purchased memberships for a theater that was just a vision, the many people who served on the redevelopment commissions, along with the Town Theater Board for their hard work. The Redevelopment Commission has a meeting scheduled for February 8th, that's a Wednesday night, where Pietro says more discussion will be held on what's next for the property. The John Dillinger Museum inside the historic Lake County Courthouse in Crown Point will offer admission of 25 cents to everyone who comes in this month. The admission charge, by the way, equates the cost of a movie ticket back in the 1930s, where Dillinger had died in a hail of bullets fired by FBI agents outside the theater in Chicago. The museum is an interactive and historic tour of the life and times of John Dillinger, as well as about the advances made in crime-fighting technology and the rise of the FBI. It also includes an exhibit of the Lake County grand jury indictments of Dillinger and his cohort John Hamilton in connection with a fatal bank robbery that happened in East Chicago. About the new documents, here's South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority Chief Executive Officer Sparrows Bautistatos.
The docket with those indictments in them have been placed on permanent loan by the County of Lake to the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority for display in the John Dillinger Museum.
And tell us, what does this thing actually look like? Is it just basically the record book that you would find at the county records?
It is. It is the record book. It is the original document. It is glued into the book as things were done back in 1934. And it's a fascinating piece of history, and we're very confident that visitors to the museum will appreciate the added value and the interest of this one-of-a-kind part of history.
Now, is this the first really official document that's in a record book that is at the museum? We know there are a lot of great things to see on display in the John Dillinger Museum in the basement of the old Lake County Courthouse, but is this the first real official document book that's been on display there?
Well, we've had copies of the indictment before, and they're on display previously, but to have the original, I think, puts some context to history that previous visits or just looking at a carbon copy of something doesn't.
Now, actually, what we have is the document of what happened after by the county courts. The grand jury handed down the indictments filed in courts by the Lake County prosecutor at the time from the January 15th, 1934 robbery of the First National Bank branch in East Chicago, and I guess there was, what about it, I guess about $20,000 taken in that robbery that John Dillinger and John Hamilton had accomplished, and unfortunately it led to the death, I guess, during the melee of police officer William O'Malley. Tell us, if you will, what some of the information that's in that the indictment.
Well, the indictment does allege that Dillinger killed Officer William O'Malley. It does have witnesses who are sworn as part of the indictment. It is signed by Robert Estill, who you mentioned was the prosecutor at the time. It's countersigned by the clerk, and it does contain the details surrounding the First National Bank robbery and the commission of murder in perpetuation of a robbery.
Mm-hmm.
And then it has some additional indictments that were subsequently dropped against at least one person, that being Ernest Blunk, who was a fingerprinter for the County of Lake at the time, and it was believed that Dillinger put a gun to his head and helped in the getaway, forced him to get in the car to give him cover during the getaway, and that indictment was subsequently dropped. But it does have all of the indictments against Dillinger and Hamilton and Ernest Blunk and another gentleman named Cahone. So it's very interesting artifacts that people will now have a chance to see.
Now, Sparrows, I understand you and Lake County Commissioner Jerry Shoup had a chance to work on this for some time. What's the procedure that Jerry had to go through to be able to borrow the book, basically, from the county records to be able to turn it over as permanent loan to the John Dillinger Museum?
Well, Commissioner Shoup explained to me that we'll be getting a document, and that document says that the book is indeed and will continue to be property of the County of Lake. But as long as we operate the Dillinger Museum, it is placed on permanent loan. If for any reason at some point in the future that the Dillinger Museum ceases to be in business, then that record book has to be returned to the County of Lake.
And I suppose, too, that if for some reason there might have to be some need to get into that record book for some other document that might be there. Certainly the museum will be happy to turn the book over for copying or whatever the case may be, to for whatever use that might be. Want some other document, some other indictment, or some other court record that's in that book too, I imagine.
I don't think there's any other cold case files in the book, Chris, but if there is a need, you can count on us to support law enforcement as we always have. We believe very strongly that the men and women in blue who are risking their lives every day, which is why we put the officer's memorial in the museum. But we would, of course, cooperate fully with any law enforcement agency who needs into that book. But I'm not aware of any outstanding cold cases from 1934, but you can count on us if there is. They can absolutely get at the book.
I would imagine, you have to go back 83 years to find a case like that if there's something that hadn't already been resolved that far back. It's interesting, too. And it's interesting, too, that we should happen to have this particular document as part of the county record that is there on display at the John Dillinger Museum, because it is, as you say, it's part of the overall display of law enforcement that's been on display at the museum since it got relocated there.
Yep. We are very, very pro-law enforcement and very much believe that telling the story of good guys, and bad guys, which Dillinger, no question, was a bad guy. And that allows us then also to showcase the great work that the men and women of blue do and did back then and are doing for us today.
The 25 cents admission offer to the John Dillinger Museum will run through February 28th during normal business hours. This is Regionally Speaking. In Troy McClendon's opinion, corrupt politicians are an inevitability. About once every 2 years, they seem to crawl out of caves and be exposed by the mainstream media. Why do they steal, embezzle, launder, cheat on spouses, and take kickbacks? Well, Gerard McClendon and his guests, Jerry Riles of the Rewind Sports 60, Kathleen Murphy of Illinois Opportunity Project, and Matt Reardon of Reardon Consulting, discuss whether term limits should be added to all government officials or just the potentially bad ones. Here's the conversation.
Politics, the people we trust, politicians, public officials, we vote them into office. We trust them. They kiss babies. They go door to door. They ask for signs to be in our yards. They may have pancake breakfasts for us, We pay their salaries, the public, but sometimes we can be so ignorant. So I ask you three, with probably the most political intelligence and acumen that I can muster on this panel, what makes politicians corrupt? Is it the nature of the job? Is the person who becomes a politician already corrupt, or do they become corrupt once they get in that position? Who dares to answer that question? Matty Matt.
All right. Thanks, Gerard, for having me on. Always love being here. Great panel, as always. Mm-hmm. Dig it. Love being on your show. Mm-hmm. And appreciate the opportunity. So I saw the topic. We were going through it a little bit. And I said, corruption. I'm like, yeah, I love politics. Use that dust off my poli-sci degree from Loras College and have a talk about this. Seems that politics and corruption have been going on since there's been politics. And, absolute power corrupts absolutely and all those things. But I think what we're getting at today with the show is what happens? I don't, honestly, I don't think to a person, people go into public office with the thought that this is how I'm going to get it.
You don't think they go in down. You don't think they go in with that mindset?
I don't believe so. At least none of the ones that I am personally familiar with. Mm-hmm. I've not met a person that says, you know what, this is it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get in there. I'm going to figure out how to weasel some cash. I'm going to steer some contracts. And we're going to direct all this dough this way, and I'm going to get paid on the back end. I haven't met anybody.
But once
now,
they
people
get in
I know... Now they've done just that, and some of them went to jail for it.
Yeah,
and I can't speak to that mindset at the time, but I when it starts out, I think people really intend to do a good job.
Yeah,
I really do.
So they come in good. They don't come in with the intent of becoming corrupt or doing something that's a corruptible, but Kathleen Murphy, it ends up happening. Now, I want to put a disclaimer out there, and actually I want to clear the air by saying that most politicians aren't bad people. Most politicians, for the most part, I would think, quantitatively aren't corrupt. But there's that small number Are they already corrupt, Kathleen? Do they come in corrupt? Do they become corrupt? What do you think?
I don't know what's in people's hearts when they start something, but I do know once they get into office, there are a lot of people around you who don't want to tell you no because they don't want to lose access, whether it's lobbyists, whether it's your staff, whether it's media people. So there are a lot of people who don't say, it's hard to tell somebody who has power over you, who's bigger than you, you can't do that. This is the wrong decision because you want, staff members want to move up the ladder too, just like politicians. They want, everybody has ambition in politics. There's no denying that. So I think that there's a lot of yes people around them, and that kind of starts to spiral with some people. I think certainly in the case of Aaron Schock, nobody told him no. And then
Aaron
we had the
Schock.
Downton Abbey office.
I think the U.S. prosecutor did, though.
That's where it stopped.
Schock thought he was invincible, mm-hmm. good-looking guy, handsome, mm-hmm.
Friends with Taylor Swift.
Friends with Taylor Swift, he's got killer abs, to be in Congress, but everyone has an Achilles heel, mm-hmm. right? Just like some athletes, Jerry Rouse from the mm-hmm. Rewind Sports 60, Pac-Man Jones in trouble again, we know that those Patriots have cheated on many occasions.
No, come on now. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. With Deflategate as well.
Come on now.
Let's fly a drone over the opponent's
America's
practices.
America's team, so to speak.
And so it happens in sports. It happens in politics. Is fairness gone, Jerry?
It depends on how you define fairness. How we learn fairness is if you treat your brother, your sister, your man equally, mm-hmm. and it's even trade or even deal. But in fairness, when you talk about politics, my interpretation is, and you said the word power. Mm-hmm. If I have power over you, and say I give a family member or one of your family members a job, then it's only fair for you to do what I ask you, whether right or wrong, because I have the power over you. I grew up in Chicago, and one thing I like to say about the city of Chicago is the city that works. Mm-hmm. The city that works against you.
Okay. Wow.
it's interesting because I kind of disagree. I think a lot of people who get involved in politics, I think that they actually know that if they get the power and the control, they can manipulate mm-hmm. people, and the word you use, Matt, the system. Yeah. So you can't go into a political arena such as Chicago or anywhere, for that matter, in my opinion, and try to be above board and be fair and be correct, because the old saying is, in order to be trusted, you have to have a little dirt on you.
Yeah. Well, and that's certainly true in Chicago and Illinois politics. I mean, if you look at people like Mike Madigan and Rahm Emanuel to some degree, too, but Mike Madigan is certainly the most powerful man in the state, and he has spent decades building this machine with layers and layers of bureaucracy protected, who are all have vested, all these people now have vested interests in him staying in power to keep these jobs, patronage, and all of that has surrounded him. So now you have thousands of people invested in keeping you in power to hold on to their little fiefdoms.
Yeah, this is interesting because in the business world, you make a widget, you sell a mm-hmm. widget, you hope that a lot of widgets are sold so you can hire more employees. So you mm-hmm. as a CEO or as a manager, as a salesperson, can make more money. And it's somewhat of a quantitative level playing field that the market basically determines. Mm-hmm. In politics, it's about power. But even though you have that power, you still have to have a moral authority. And so I'm going to go through some of these names, and then you guys jump right in. I see you, Jerry. I see you, Matt. You got Alderman Willie Cochran, who's been indicted. But in the same, I believe, ward back in the day, Cliff Kelly was indicted. Orenda Troutman was indicted. Almost a ward that has been plagued by corrupt politicians. We're looking at Congressman Schock, Jesse Jackson Jr., Jesse Jackson Jr.'s wife, Sandy, let's spend some misappropriated funds locally. Man, we got Sheriff Buntzich with an indictment, and the list goes on and on. Earlier, Kathleen, you brought up Rita Crunwell, comptroller of Dixon, Illinois, embezzles $53.7 million with that cute little innocent face riding horseback. Who would have thought that this would occur? It just keeps happening by people who we don't think would do this. Matt.
So when people are complicit in the crime, that's what builds up these layers. So now you've got, hey, I took care of you, guy, you take care of me, and everybody kind of knows how it is. And, you know, the one thing I'll say about all this political corruption and campaign finance and all of it is tied directly together. You know what? The Indiana General Assembly opened up, let's see, the House was today. I wonder how many bills directed at campaign finance reform were filed. I'm guessing none.
Wow.
Because you know when they do, you know what happens? They get thrown in the round file. Mm-hmm. The last substantive change we've had in federal legislation related to campaign finance and money and power related to being able to cloak where you got the money from in order to get the power. So inherently in the system that we've set up, we allow people to make a living being lobbyists to go tell people who are elected, Gerard, hey, this is the best thing for you, and I'm going to tell you why. In the meantime, I'm getting paid by Big Pharma or somebody else to go tell you what and why. Perfectly legal. So there are elected officials that understand that there are legal methods to work in, and there are people who cross that line. I was told by a gentleman, and God rest his soul, Jim Shanahan, he told me, he said, you know one thing, Matt? He goes, there's plenty of money to make in government, honestly, because they always have it to spend.
Wow, this is interesting because, and I'm going to talk about AAU sports and tie it into politics in the next segment. But, Jerry, you had a comment before we break.
No, I just know that there was something. We talked about the smaller townships, and there's a gentleman I know who's a village president of a particular town, and he was out of work. His home was under foreclosure. The community leaders knew he was desperate. And so what they did, and these are big time players in this village, and they approached him and said, hey, we will make you the village president, but you have to work under our guidance and be our puppet, so to speak.
Oh.
And so, and you would think that this was an honest guy, family man, but he knew exactly what he needed. He knew where to go, and he capitalized on it, and his life certainly changed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, corruption in politics, it goes hand in hand, unfortunately, the way that I see it.
At the counterpoint, I've got Jerry Riles from the Rewind Sports 60, Kathleen Murphy, Illinois Opportunity Project, and Matt Reardon from MRC Partners. Thanks for sticking with me for the next segment here. I was thinking about sports and how sports has a political bent and politics has sometimes an athletic or sports bent. There seems to be opponents trying to get the upper hand, the edge on the other opponent, throwing dirt, showing prowess. And I was watching an amazing documentary on AAU basketball and how corrupt at times it can be. And so there's this interesting cycle where AAU teams are basically sponsored by the shoe companies. All right. So the shoe companies want to make sure that their emblem, their logo is out there. The shoe companies, they basically are pay for the games, the scouts, and the camps, all right? This gives exposure to the young basketball players, which can range from 6 years old all the way up through 18 or so. And then what's interesting is while everyone's making all this money and while everyone's getting their number one through number 13 or 14 scouting choices with the universities, the children are lured by the shoes. Wow. So the people with all the talent, even on the AAU level, are being exposed, you know, or I should say exploited. All right. So the same goes for politics. You know, are we in a situation where once I get that power, I can just exploit? Is that the reason why a person should go? I'm looking at some names here, and it's frightening because a lot of these names are people who we thought were honest people. Blagojevich, what did Blagojevich do? Hey, he reduced the prices in Illinois for seniors' pharmaceutical products and prescriptions. He also got free public transportation for seniors. He can't be that bad of a guy. I'm looking at Otto Kerner, governor from 1961 to 1968 in Illinois, spent 3 years in prison after being convicted of bribery. There's always Governor Ryan. License for man that you and the list goes on. Dan Walker pleaded guilty to bank fraud 1987. Anthony Weiner, you talk about public trust. Anthony Weiner, happily married, puts a little mousse in his hair, falls in some kind of lust with a young lady on the internet. Pardon the plural. And he starts sexting. Really? Really? Are these the people that we, what do we do about this?
Well, in Washington, D.C., some of the stories that we're hearing, Gerard, that we're talking about, and some of the people that you've mentioned, which is surprising, but some people allege that on Capitol Hill in New York that, you know, more and worse things are taking place, mm-hmm. but because of the arena, because of the people involved, and because of power mm-hmm. that they possess, it goes under the table. So
should we be surprised by this? Because, and the reason why you're on the show today is because this, I don't know if we expect it to happen in sports, but at the same time, we still want sports to be fair. We don't want people juicing up on steroids. We don't want people using banned substances. But at the same time, we do want to see the long ball. But we want to see home runs,
politics,
don't we?
You're right. I mean, it's politics, you know, you have a politician coming out of school, you know, a bright lawyer. You know, you start grooming him early on and get him accustomed to the game of how it's played and who are the major players and who are not the major players. The same with sport. You use the word exploit. Mm-hmm. I kind of go back and forth on the fence as far as exploiting these kids because, one, the kids and their parents want to be in this AAU arena
right.
because of the exposure. Mm-hmm. And two, it puts them on a higher platform and let people know that I am the next tier, so to speak. I'm the next generation. And many of the professional athletes that we're watching currently today on Sundays when we, you know, turn on, you know, the NFL or we turn on the NBA, a lot of these players have been groomed. The NHL, they've all been groomed to reach a certain level.
Just like politicians.
Exactly.
A lot of politicians are groomed. A lot of them have same family name. That family name goes a long way. Kathleen, you had a comment.
Well, you know, I just... It seems to me that some of this should be on us because there is an attitude in the populace in general and in the Republican Party and kind of those who lean libertarian that, you know, all I care about is keeping my taxes low and whatever they do in their private life, I don't care. I don't care. And that all of this goes to character. Mm. I mean, every politician that you've listed off, this all goes to character, what you're willing to do and what you're willing to compromise and how much of yourself you're willing to compromise. I mean, maybe we should care a little bit more about what they do in their private lives and not just care about keeping our taxes. I mean, maybe we should look at those things and that should matter to voters a little bit more.
So Rich James wrote an interesting article a few years ago, Northwest Indiana editorialist, and he said that term limits probably aren't the answer. Yes, a term limit will work for someone who is totally corrupt. We want that person out, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, a term limit could get rid of someone whose time has expired and then they're kicked out of office because of the term limit, but they may have been doing a fantastic job. So I want to talk about term limits as far as footnote B, but footnote A, I want to go to Matt Reardon on this. Matt, MRC Partners, before that, you've worked in some pretty high-powered jobs in economic development.
Yep.
You've managed, you've facilitated extremely large multi-million-dollar budgets. When it comes to public office and when it comes to the public dollar, you know what, Matt? Correct me if I'm wrong. It's easy to steal public money. You just
read a list of about 50 people that didn't have much problem doing it.
Yeah.
And I guess it's there for the taking because, and I suppose it's things like lack of term limits, and the argument goes back and forth. You know, the voting booth is the term limit, the ultimate term limit. But with that being said, you know, the way that, you know, Indiana, for example, is laid out in Rich James' article. It's like, well, you know, why does the sheriff have only two terms and why does the surveyor have no terms? And I'll say this. Look, first of all, why am I electing these people anyway?
Wow. Right?
So then I don't have to worry about it. So I have a sheriff, I hire a law enforcement person. Now, the head of the FBI isn't elected. He's appointed. So as far as the assessor, I get a real estate professional. What are you doing? You're assessing property or an appraiser, and so on. Mm. So there's room to, if the change wants to happen, if people have the financial wherewithal to make it known and to push the elected officials to do so. But as I said, how many bills at the Indiana General Assembly right now are talking about term limits or a campaign finance reform? How many in Illinois are about campaign finance reform? Who in Washington, D.C. has mentioned anything about, hey, you know, we got to get this campaign finance under control? In the meantime, you have all these presidents in the past election, the presidents, the senators, and the congressmen spending all this money, and the system continues.
The system continues. So,
let me say this to you. You know, we talk about and we joke about Chicago being a city, you know, whatever. But if you really look at it, and Kathleen, you talk about the people have to stop it. Mm-hmm. It's not going to stop because here's why it's not going to stop. You have the mayor of the city of Chicago, the current one, Rahm Emanuel, the former Mayor Daley. And no mayor has been under any type of corruption in the city of Chicago over the past 40-plus years, maybe further than that. And the reason being is because of the layers that they have surrounding them that protects them. And that's why you see these aldermen fall into the wayside, because they are the scapegoat for the head of the political machine, which is the mayor in the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Now, if you remember when Rahm Emanuel was up for election, he was really afraid and really nervous, and people came out to say they weren't going to vote for him. But what happened were the community leaders and activists that got him in the room, sat him down, and said, this is what you need to do for our community if you want to maintain that seat. So when you talk about the people coming in and make a difference, it's the community leaders looking to get a piece of that pie, some of that scratch, you know, get their...
So that cheese.
Exactly.
So Jerry Ryle, so you're, you know I got to bring a sports analogy in because you're the Rewind Sports 60. So you're saying that the mayor of Chicago, which is arguably one of the most powerful political offices that you can hold in the United States, if not the world, you're saying that the mayor of Chicago has a better offensive line than other politicians, regardless of, so you're saying that they have a better offensive line than, let's say, possibly the governor, congressman, senator.
He had a better. He's got a better offensive line than Rod Blagojevich had, because he didn't have any buffers.
Yeah,
and George Ryan.
Blagojevich, his was just pure. You know, so we go from power to greed, and that's so. With the power, he really overstepped his boundary because of the greed involved. And when, you know, you guys remember the old Flintstones, Fred Flintstones and the dollar signs, jing, 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 jing. Yeah. That was Rob Blagojevich because he saw the dollar signs and he just totally got blind.
He couldn't stop.
But there is still an attitude in Illinois politics among, I'm not going to say one party or the other, but people who were close to that investigation and close to that the punishment was way too severe for the crime because everybody does it. I mean, that's kind of the attitude, and I was really surprised to hear that. But you know what? They said the punishment did not fit the attitude in Illinois
but
politics.
But that's true.
14 years is a pretty long time.
It is
for
true.
What that guy did. And well, you know what?
And he
didn't have a buffer.
No, right. But the reason it's so severe is because they wanted to make an example of him because he was boisterous and arrogant. And every time he got in front of the cameras, he would boast, hey, listen to all the tapes. Mm-hmm. I want you to hear everything. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you're bugging me. Mm-hmm. And so if you're in that political arena and you know the criteria, you can't start pointing fingers and start... You can't do that, and that's why they're setting an example.
Yeah, I understand
that. You can't point fingers and be arrogant When you have perfect
when
hair.
You're wrong.
You have perfect hair like Ron Blagojevich, which is going from black to totally gray behind bars right now. Matt Reardon, you're going to get the last word, man. I got about 15 seconds. You're saying campaign finance reform,
I'm saying, listen, this all ties back to the money. So I have a system that's built on lobbyists that have money, that fund campaigns, that have an expectation of results and access. So that's the system.
Yeah.
So until that, there's substantive changes to how the system works, it's in play. There's plenty of rules to follow. You know, elected officials need to follow them, as do the consultants that work in that arena. As I said, the government's never going to run out of money, and if they do, we're all in trouble.
Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon airs on Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore Public Television, and it's rebroadcast Sunday mornings at 10.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is a part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. On this week's episode, we'll be traveling to a place of Hoosier ingenuity and invention. In this scientific laboratory, major discoveries were made that lay the groundwork for everything we know today about genetics. This lab we're exploring isn't fancy, and it's not in some sleek, futuristic-looking building. It's in an attic. Yes. Today we are exploring Salvador Eluria's attic lab in Kirkwood Hall at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, in the 1940s. Luria designed the most significant experiment of his career using bacteriophages during a faculty dance at Indiana University Bloomington. Bacteriophages are tiny viruses that only infect bacteria. He was near a slot machine that caused him to wonder about machines. He observed that a person can't win at a slot machine every time they pull the lever. There must be a pattern to winning and losing. He thought that maybe this pattern of winning and losing was like the pattern of some bacteria developing resistance to bacteriophages and some not. The following morning, Luria ran to his attic lab that he shared with two students and 18 rabbits. This experiment was called the fluctuations test, and it showed that bacteriophages and bacteria were perfect to study genetics on. And there, in Luria's attic lab, the field of molecular biology was born. Bloomington was a place of scientific and personal growth for Luria. Luria met and married his wife Zella in 1945. And through his roommate, a scholar of English literature, Luria became fascinated with the humanities. Later in his career at MIT, he even taught a world literature class in addition to his courses on bacteriology. During Luria's 45 years as a research scientist, he won the Nobel Prize in Physiology, was president of the American Society for Microbiology, and founded and directed the Cancer Center at MIT. Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives by creating and facilitating programs that encourage Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.